From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina has enacted major reforms in recent years involving alcohol. We'll recap them and look ahead to other government restrictions that have outlived their usefulness. The UNC Board of Governors continues to look for ways to ensure viewpoint diversity on campuses. You'll hear one board member's concerns about the topic. Harvard has drawn fire in recent years for its admissions policy. A Duke economist shares results from his analysis of Harvard's admission numbers. Plus, we'll examine key facts and figures from North Carolina's latest public school teacher turnover report. Are teachers fleeing the state? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Well, it is called Super Tuesday, the day that North Carolina and a handful of other key battleground states will go to the polls to decide who will compete in November's general election. Now, here in our state, we're talking about statewide races and offices, including governor, federal offices, the U.S. Senate, of course, at the state level, the General Assembly, and President of the United States as well. All of these things on the March primary ballot. Carolina Journal is covering all of the key races. And Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us now to talk about what could be ahead. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Early voting now underway for the March primary. No photo ID required
to vote.
Why
That's
not?
Right. Voters in 2018 said we will require the Constitution, or we'll place in the Constitution a provision that voter ID shall be required at the polls, but the courts have said not so fast. And it continues to be tied up in various court battles over whether or not the photo ID requirement that was passed by the General Assembly, the enabling legislation, in some way disenfranchises elderly, minority, other voters, and it's up in the air for now.
It seems like it would be a tough sell, that argument, considering that that enabling legislation had a whole slew of different things that you could use as identification.
And The issue that's always that North Carolina is always going to be facing with any election related legislation, constitutional amendments and the like, is that we are a former state of the Confederacy, and that for years, if not decades, there was active suppression of minority votes. And so we face a higher threshold than other similar states. And so even though states not quite neighboring may have voter ID requirements that are more stringent than ours, than the one that we've proposed, at least, it doesn't matter. And so we also have a situation in which at the federal level, at least, the governing Court of Appeals circuit, the Fourth Circuit, is fairly hostile toward conservatives right now. And so those judges tend to look askance at attempts to solidify the requirements for voting. And so, I mean, it's a situation right now. It's just a confluence of events. It's going to make this very difficult. And it's quite possible that we will not have voter ID for even the fall cycle of the election.
So the ballot, the March 3rd ballot, is really quite full. Some very interesting races. Let's start with the one for governor. Now, we know that the Democratic incumbent, Roy Cooper, wants a second term. So he's on the ballot along with Ernest Tyrone Reeves. That's the Democratic primary. On the Republican side, Rick, we have Dan Forrest, the current lieutenant governor, and Holly Grange, who is a state legislator. Assess that race for us.
Well, Dan Forrest should be walking away with it, and as far as all the initial polling is concerned, he is walking away with it. But there are some issues of concern for the Forrest camp involving a donor, Greg Lindberg from Durham, who was operating an series of insurance companies. Some have said it was a Ponzi scheme that he set up, and he attempted to use according to prosecutors, he's now been indicted and is now facing charges of essentially bribing public officials to try to get favorable treatment for his insurance companies. And there were a large number of campaign contributions made to a political action committee that was supporting Dan Forrest. There are campaign contributions. There's allegedly some contact between the Forrest staff and Mr. Lindbergh and Mr. Lindbergh's associates. And so this is now continuing to unfold as we speak. And Dan Forrest should be the lead pipe cinch nominee, but he may not be. And the Grange camp, she's a New Hanover County state representative, represents the military community there, is, I'm guessing, just sort of hanging on by her fingernails, hoping that something happens to overturn the narrative about this race, because otherwise Dan Forrest should win the primary. And if he does, he could well be a damaged candidate going into the general election.
So that's going to be fascinating to see how that one turns out for the race for governor. The lieutenant governor race is quite interesting as well. We have lots and lots of people, Democrats and Republicans, who are in this primary. So in the lieutenant governor's Democratic primary, we have Alan Thomas, Bill Toole, Terry Van Dyne, Chaz Beasley, Yvonne Lewis-Hawley, and Ron Newton. Over on the Republican side, we've got John Ritter, Mark Robinson, Scott Stone, Andy Wells, Buddy Bengel, Deborah Cochran, Renee Elmers, Greg Gebhardt, and Mark Johnson. Why does everybody want to be lieutenant governor?
Because they think it's the easiest way to be governor eventually, and also because as former Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr said, you really don't have to do a whole lot. The lieutenant governor's duties, by and large, depend on the largesse of the governor to some extent. I mean, you are a member of the State Board of Education. You have other board and commission memberships for which you have some power. You are a member of the Council of State, so you get to vote on things like debt and real estate purchases and things like that. But the General Assembly has essentially removed most of the lieutenant governor's formal powers. And so it's a position that essentially allows someone who has ambitions to be governor to potentially travel around the state, network, and build a campaign war chest for a later run for other office, whether it's – and governor seems to be the one that is preferred by these candidates. It's a crowded field because it will be an open race. But I think what's very interesting is that some of the people who were on that list, for instance, current superintendent of public instruction Mark Johnson, who abandoned that job after one term to run for lieutenant governor, former member of Congress Renee Elmers, who's really not raised much money at all, and then Scott Stone, a former member of the General Assembly, who has raised a lot of money. And so it's going to be very interesting to see if anybody gains any traction and if we're going to go through or if we're going to have a runoff. And in both parties.
The lieutenant governor, I think you described it, of course, accurately. But also, isn't it true, Rick, that that person really would take over as governor should, heaven forbid, something happen to the governor of the state incapacitated in some way?
That's right. That's exactly right. Next in line of succession to the governor, which causes occasionally interesting situations. We had this with Beverly Perdue a couple of terms ago when she was at the Kentucky Derby at a sorority party when we had a catastrophe happen and nobody knew where she was because she apparently didn't let people know that she was gone. You've had current Governor Roy Cooper playing some games when he's been out of state traveling because essentially when he's not in the state of North Carolina, this is, Dan Forrest is the acting governor. And so, I mean, you do have these kinds of games that are often played among the two offices to see who's in charge and how much notification you're going to give and things like that.
So, Rick, in our remaining time here, let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. We've got a five-person field on the Democratic side, Erica Smith, Steve Swenson, Cal Cunningham, Trevor Fuller, and Atul Goel. On the Republican side, Tom Tillis, Paul Wright, Larry Holmquist, Sharon Hudson.
It's still, I think, on the Democratic side, a two-person race between Erica Smith and Cal Cunningham. Cal Cunningham has the support of the Democratic establishment. He spent a lot of money. Erica Smith seems to have more of a grassroots support and has actually done okay with fundraising. So that's going to be of interest. On the Republican side, Tom Tillis, it's his race to lose.
And of course, Carolina Journal covering all of these races at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has made great strides in recent years when it comes to reforming alcohol regulations, but it could take other positive steps. Joining us to recap what has happened and to look ahead to the future of alcohol law reform is John Trump. He is managing editor of Carolina Journal, and he's also author of Still and Barrel, a book about distilleries in North Carolina. Welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Mitch.
So there certainly has been a lot of movement in recent years on changing the rules linked to alcohol. What have been some of the top things you've seen?
Well, as distilleries began, they could not sell their product on site. And that changed with McCrory allowing the one bottle. Then it became five bottles. So this past year, a bill was passed through the legislature allowing them to sell as many bottles as they can, which, you know, is great for people wanting to have a wedding or want to feature a specific North Carolina, you know, spirit. Also, liquor tastings at ABC stores. They're now allowed to open up bars. Technically, there are no bars in North Carolina, but they can now sell beer and wine along with their liquor, as long as they get the required permits and tastings at ABC stores, things like that, which goes a long way to helping people in a flooded market, in a market dominated by the so-called big boys, the Jim Beams, Crown Royals, and so forth. And it gives them a leg up, yet, you know, as we've talked before, we're still hampered by a monopolistic North Carolina ABC system.
Yeah, so for people who haven't really followed this, the old rules were it was very hard for anyone who operated a distillery to be able to sell their own product. You mentioned that for a while you could sell one bottle to a customer per year.
Per year.
Then it went
up
to five, and now it's unlimited. So that has to be a major positive change for people who are trying to make a business out of this.
Well, right. There was no way. If you look at wineries and breweries, they can sell their own products, and they basically always have been able to, which I think a brewery makes – and there are breweries who don't can and just sell from the brewery itself. A distillery would have to go through all the ABC rules to get their product in the store just to even get on the shelf. But now people can come to the distillery and sample. They can have a cocktail where before they could have a shot of warm liquor, straight warm liquor, which a lot of people just don't really care for. But it gets them to sell their own product in their own business, which is a huge step. And the unlimited sales are big too, because before they would have to track it. If, you know, you came in and bought a bottle of rum, Mitch bought one bottle of rum, you come back again and you could only do five. Now they don't have to worry about the bureaucratic red tape where people could just buy it at will. And it allows these guys, it's really used for them. I mean, now, let me say, total reform is needed to take the ABC out of the equation altogether. And, you know, then you get into the local boards, but that's another problem. But to your question, yes, this has been a huge step.
Yeah, we're going to get back to future reforms in just a bit, but we've been talking about distilleries. There's also been major change in terms of beer and wine, especially beer. The craft beer industry had a huge gain in the last couple of years, too.
Right. They were limited by, and it took a lawsuit from Noda and Old Mec. They were limited to how much beer they could make. And I think it was up to 25,000 barrels. And a lot of – and Old Mec and Noda, for example, were stopping at 24,000 barrels before they had to get a distributor. And the state forced them to get a distributor, which John Marino at Old Mec had argued that it takes away their branding. They wanted to do their own thing. They wanted to distribute themselves. Now, this allows them to up to 100,000 barrels where they can make, which – and they're really not going to catch that limit. That's pretty high up there, but it's – you know, the 25,000 was too low, and this allows them to operate their business as they see fit without government strangulation.
We're chatting with John Trump. He is managing editor of Carolina Journal and author of the book Still and Barrel, which is about distilleries in North Carolina. Common theme seems to be government telling these brewers, vintners, distillers how they can operate mm-hmm. their business. It sounds like there's still quite a bit of area where there could be positive reform.
Right. I think they're hampered by these boards. I think the biggest problem with distillers now, you know, comparatively, we're a large wine we've blown up. We're the largest brewer in the South, I believe. But the problem is with the ABC boards, there are 170 boards or so in the state.
In our 100 counties.
In our 100 counties.
So more
counties.
Than Humber County.
And it's odd because like some of the beach counties, Brunswick County has 9 ABC stores. And Rockingham County has 3 ABC stores. Mecklenburg has 1 ABC store. Wake has – I mean not stores but boards. And – you know, Wake has one board. So what they've got to do is they've got to go to each board and say, will you please put my product in your store? Then it's up to them to put it in a store. And there's political hard feelings and so on and so forth. So a lot of these people don't get into the local store. Plus, if you're in Manteo and you want to put your product in Waynesville, well, it's up to you to go there and say, will you put my product in the store. So much more needs to be done. And, you know, Chuck McGrady last year had a bill to privatize. It got a hearing. It really didn't go anywhere, but at least it's on the table. And what he wanted was to get heard, to abolish the boards. Now, there was a cap on the boards. Now, there can't be any more boards. So it's capped at 170. So the idea is, because they get a piece of the revenue, you know, well, let's open up a ABC board here so we could get some of it, because that money goes back to the counties or the municipality, and that's part of the holdup here is where's that money going to come from should the ABC boards go away.
Sounds as if that whatever happens, there is a lot of opportunity to make some changes that are going to help these businesses flourish, whether it is the brewers and getting rid of some of their restrictions, or even to a greater extent, the distillers, taking some steps that would get government out of the way and let them operate their businesses.
Well, two is, you know, happy hour could help. There's no happy hour now in North Carolina where they could feature, you know, a distillery for a couple hours as opposed to all day, which is what it is now. Direct online sales is a big one. And this has come up with some ridiculous arguments against it in the past. You can't technically in North Carolina, you can't have alcohol shipped to you, or you can't ship it to other states, which forces these distillers to move to like Maryland or wherever a company that gets that excise tax coming back. Sunday sales is a big one too. That was in the original bill, but got struck down. Where, you know, like I say, if I want a chicken sandwich on a Sunday, right, I got choices. I could go to Bojangles. I could go to Chick-fil-A. I can go
not on Sunday, though.
Popeye. But the chicken sandwich I can get,
right.
But the alcohol I can't get. So, Yeah, that's a big part of it. And even the distilleries on Sunday, if they were allowed to open and sell their product, would immensely help these guys and women.
Well, there's certainly many more things that could be done. And one person who's going to be watching very closely as this debate plays out is John Trump. He is managing editor of Carolina Journal and author of the book Still and Barrel about distilleries in North Carolina. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The University of North Carolina faces continuing questions about its efforts to ensure viewpoint diversity on campus. UNC System Board of Governors member Steve Long is one of those asking questions. In a recent public forum, he noted the importance of maintaining academic freedom. He quoted from accepted standards tied to academic freedom.
As scholars and educational officers, they should remember that the public may judge their profession and their institution by their utterances. Hence, they should at all times be accurate, should exercise appropriate restraint, should show respect for the opinions of others, and should make every effort to indicate that they are not speaking for the institution. And in many instances, I saw that was being violated at UNC Law School.
Long shared one description he's heard about the UNC Law School faculty.
If it were a football team, you'd have 11 players devoted to civil rights and one to business law. And, you know, sure enough, I went and looked at the profile of the professors, and it was that case. And in my law firm, we had clerks from UNC, and they said, oh, they can find all the civil rights courses they want, but it's tough sometimes to get into the business courses. Now, I know the current dean is trying to change that. They've had three ideologically very leftist deans in the, for many, many years. And so the whole faculty has basically gone from being a school. I call it a club. It's really a club. But I think the viewpoint diversity is a big problem in the university. I think most of what happens in the university is good. Our kids are getting, you know, good educations for good jobs. But there are problems.
Long says viewpoint diversity among the faculty is an important issue.
It's very frustrating to me on how to fix it, but I've come to the conclusion that it's a structural problem. Because just to give you an example of what was described to me, in order to get a job at UNC Law School on the faculty, there's a committee that the dean will appoint to hire the person, but the candidate has to go around and meet all the other faculty. And then they'll have a big faculty meeting to talk about the candidate. Well, they'll never hire a conservative because they don't want anybody in the club. And I have come to believe that we need to centralize the management of academic institutions so that if you don't have viewpoint diversity, you can go talk to the leader or group of leaders and say, you have a problem here. You need to bring in different points of view. And I've come to that. I don't know if that's actually the solution, but I think it should be considered and thought through.
That's Steve Long, member of the UNC System's Board of Governors. He's talking about the struggle to ensure viewpoint diversity on campus. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Harvard University has faced a legal challenge to its admissions process. Critics contend that the process unfairly penalizes Asian American students. During a recent public lecture, Duke University economist Peter Arcidiacono discussed his review of Harvard's admissions numbers. He focused attention on ALDCs. That's the name assigned to students admitted because they're recruited athletes, legacy students with a parental connection to Harvard, students who appear on something called the Dean's Interest List, and children of Harvard faculty and staff.
Little over 56% of whites who are admitted are non-ALDCs. So that means is over 43% of whites are ALDC. But over 43% of white admits are ALDC. The similar fraction for any of the other three major groups here, African Americans, Hispanics, and Asian Americans, is always less than 16%. The other, I think, absolutely remarkable number is they say all these less than 16% of African Americans, Hispanics, and Asian Americans are ALDC. That's actually less than what it is for athletes. Over 16% of white admits are recruited athletes. What is going on here? That just blew me away when I first saw it. Well, it turns out that Harvard has more sports than any other school in the country. Harvard is not the biggest school. They have more sports than any other school in the country. And not only that, they don't give athletic scholarships, right? So we're not talking about, I'm sure there are sports that Harvard is stellar at. They're not going to be football or basketball, but sports maybe like crew or something of that nature, okay? But if you're going to keep adding sports, the sports you add are white and privileged, basically. So it's the sailing team. Okay? I could say others, but I don't want to insult anybody in the room. All these people who are athletes, they spend a ton of time doing this stuff. It's a big commitment. But nonetheless, do you think we ought to give automatic admissions to the sailing team? That seems like not the best use of resources.
Athletic preferences at Harvard might not fit your preconceived notions.
I went to a large public school. I can't, I had no hope of making the soccer team. Zero hope, okay? Both my wife and I, we got like needs improvement in the running when we were young. My second son came home from school one day and says, "Why is it that all the kids run faster than me?" We're like, "Bad genes." But it's going to pay off later, okay? Why am I telling you this? Because you have more opportunities to be on sports teams if you go to small private schools. And my kids do get to play on the soccer team. Okay, so it all works to your advantage. Also, whether you're a captain of a team. Well, if your private school offers lots of sports relative to the size of your school. And the reason I think that this is really important is that normally we think about holistic admissions, taking into account the non-academic stuff, as leveling the playing field. And it does across race. So if you look at those academic ratings, if we look at African Americans, their academic ratings are way lower than whites. That's in partly because of the way Harvard does its recruitment for students. But across races, you definitely want to put less weight on that academic rating to get more of a balancing. But within races, that's not the case. Within races, you actually see that things like the personal rating, boy, those legacies do great on the personal rating, right? That's not overcoming hardship. Holistic admissions actually, within race, would seem to actually move us towards more inequality. I'm actually concerned about movements away from, you know, the SAT and such. Yes, you can buy higher test scores. But it actually might be easier for you to buy some of these other things. You know, my oldest son, he worked for free for a Duke computer science professor one summer. He doesn't get that job except through connections, and he's able to work for free because we can afford to do that. Those types of things can be bought as well.
That's Duke University economist Peter Arcidiacono. He's discussing his research into Harvard's admissions data. He says policymakers ought to look into why such a high percentage of black applicants rank so poorly on academic scores. And that's not all.
We also need to figure out what the heck these Asian American families are doing. Look at this. Almost 18% are in the top decile. This is the best decile. That's over twice what it is for white students. Okay, so one of the things they say is, oh, well, if you actually look at the admission rates for non-ALDC, white students are slightly behind Asian American students. Well, yeah, they're not doing near as well academically as the Asian American applicants. It's stunning.
What happens when you look at applicants from the lowest part of the academic pool?
The white admission rate for LDCs is 6.3%. Okay, that's actually higher than the average admit rate for white applicants, which is like 4.95%. It's pretty striking.
The Duke economist reviewed Harvard's legal claim about the impact of its admission standards on Asian American students.
Harvard's claim was that Asian Americans were less multidimensional than whites. Now that alone may be a little offensive, but where that came from is those four ratings I talked about up front: the academic rating, extracurricular rating, athletic rating, and personal rating. And if you add all those up, which you shouldn't be adding up in the first place, because these are numbers don't have any meaning, then it turns out that they might be slightly lower when you add them all up. Now, as it turns out, Asian Americans had much higher academic ratings than whites, and they had higher extracurricular ratings. But they did have lower personal ratings, which I think is already subject to bias, and lower athletic ratings. So they were multidimensional because they weren't on the sailing team.
What would happen if Harvard scrapped its non-racial preferences?
Almost three quarters of white admits who are ALDC would be rejected if they'd been treated like their non-ALDC counterparts. And from that, you can say, well, what would the admit rate look like for ALDC applicants? It would fall to 11.4% from 43.6%. Now you say, well, maybe all those, that falls all driven by athletes. Well, let's assume that all the athletes were rejected as a result of this. What would be the admit rate be for LDCs? Well, that's just 14%. So it would fall from 33 to 14. This is as high as it can be. So pretty big changes. If you get rid of athlete preferences, what's remarkable is African Americans don't go down at all. They go down by one. Okay, it's only whites that go down if you get rid of athletic preferences at Harvard. The other ones go up. But if you get rid of all three, race, legacy, and athlete, see, whites actually go up, but it's just tiny. African Americans go way down, Hispanics go way down, and Asian Americans skyrocket. Asian Americans get hammered. They lose out because of legacy and athlete preferences. They lose out because of racial preferences. And then on top of that, Harvard rates them worse on the personal rating and has a penalty for them. That's because Asian Americans are just doing incredibly well.
That's Peter Arcidiacono, economics professor at Duke University. He's discussing the impact of athletic and legacy admissions preferences at Harvard. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Each year, some North Carolina public school teachers leave the profession, leave the system. We know how many leave each year and have at least a glimpse of why through the annual report on the state of the teaching profession. That new report has now been released to the State Board of Education. Dr. Terry Stoops of the John Locke Foundation is here to review the data. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So there's two different categories. It's kind of interesting. One called attrition, one called mobility. Give us a sense of the numbers.
Sure. Well, last year, the attrition rate was 7.5% and the mobility rate was 4.5%. And the fact that the report fleshes out those two numbers is important because in the past, there was one teacher turnover rate that was provided by the state. And of course, that was much higher because it combined the mobility rate, which is the percentage, the number of teachers that are moving from one public school to another, and the attrition rate, the number of teachers that are leaving the profession. And so the fact that the report fleshes out these two numbers and separates them and categorizes them in the ways that that are provided in the report is an important point to make, because I don't think many people would be concerned about public school teachers moving from one public school to another. That's just them deciding that one public school is a better fit for them than another. It's the attrition rate that people are really concerned about, and that's what I think is important to zero in on.
What's your assessment of the rate? What does it mean?
Well, that's the real question that everyone wants to ask. Is the attrition rate a reflection of how teachers feel about the profession? And it's really hard to say from the results of this report What we can say is over the last 3 years, the attrition rate has declined significantly. 3 years ago was 8.7%, and last year it was 7.5%. That's a significant decrease. So that's the first aspect. The second is the largest category of teachers that are leaving are those who retired. And of course, if they're deciding to retire, then they should be able to retire.
Right.
So that isn't the type of attrition that we would normally associate with dissatisfaction. These are teachers that have the ability to be able to leave the profession and retire, and they do so. Really, the categories that we're most concerned about are teachers that are changing careers, teachers that are choosing to teach in another state or dissatisfied with teaching. And that's only around 1,600 teachers of the 7,000 that left the profession last year. So it's a relatively small percentage of not only the number of teachers that left the profession, but the total 95,000 teachers or so that taught in our public schools in 2018-19.
So, Terry, if someone leaves the profession and decides after 2 years, 5 years, 10 years that it's just not their thing, I mean, is that necessarily a bad thing? Would we want someone in a classroom who isn't totally committed and wanting to be there?
Absolutely not. And that's the good thing. That's the good part about attrition is that there are teachers that don't want to be in the classroom and that frankly aren't good teachers. And we should want them to leave and get replaced by teachers that are higher performing. One of the real innovations in the report since they revised it a few years ago is that it started looking at the growth scores of teachers that remained in the profession and those that left. And what the researchers found is that the growth scores, this is the test score growth of students from 1 year to the next about whether they're growing one grade level or not, find that teachers that leave have lower growth scores than those who stay. We want those teachers to leave because that it's showing that they are not producing the type of academic results that their peers are producing. And so the fact that they are leaving the profession is actually a good thing. And really the hope is that schools will then be able to recruit teachers that will replace those ones that will provide a higher quality education for the students that remain in public schools.
Terry, we for the past several years have heard a pretty consistent narrative from some of the quasi-union activists and education bureaucracy supporters that, well, North Carolina teachers just aren't respected by the members of the General Assembly and they're not paid well enough. And so they're leaving the profession in droves. As you mentioned, that attrition rate has gone down. But talk to us a little bit about teacher pay and where we were a few years ago and where we are today.
Well, just to give a sense of how much average teacher pay has increased, between 2014 and 2019, the average teacher pay is up by 20%. And teachers, on average, are making around $55,000 a year. We'll get new teacher pay averages very soon for this current school year. And that doesn't include the benefits, the significant increase in benefits that teachers have received over that same period. Now, if I were someone that was leading a union effort, I would point out the fact that teacher salaries have increased and attrition has decreased and make the connection between the two. You could easily make the argument that the reason why more teachers are staying in the profession is because salaries have increased. Unfortunately, the North Carolina Association of Educators doesn't want to give any credit to the Republican General Assembly for raising teacher pay and therefore refuses to make that argument.
Why not? I mean, I'm befuddled by that because they are essentially a worker rights movement. And if your workers, the members of the NCAE, are making more money each year, wouldn't you want to celebrate that as a victory for your movement?
You absolutely would. But the fact that it's really dominated by party politics and the North Carolina Association of Educators has aligned itself with the Democratic Party, despite its refusal to admit that fact, there's plenty of evidence out there that shows that there is a close alignment between the North Carolina Association of Educators and the Democratic Party. So the fact that the Republicans have been the ones responsible for raising teacher pay and perhaps lowering the attrition rate is not consistent with their partisan political views.
And interesting that the bipartisan passed state budget that Governor Roy Cooper vetoed actually had another teacher pay raise in it. But that hasn't been implemented because he vetoed the budget.
That's right. Now, just because the budget was vetoed doesn't mean that we won't see an increase in average teacher pay. It's important to remind the audience that teachers are paid based on experience and credentials. So any increase in the average number of years of experience or the number of teachers that have certain credentials that we pay a supplement for will increase the average. So it's possible that when the data comes out in February, sometime in February, the Department of Public Instruction will release the data for the average teacher pay for the current year. We might see another average pay increase, even though we don't have the budget that either the governor or the General Assembly wanted to pass.
Terry, you are a former school teacher. What do you say to someone who might be interested in the profession? What qualities do you tell them are important to have? And what about expectations for leading a classroom?
Well, a lot of the best teachers that I have been around will say that it's about relationships with the students and understanding what the students' needs are and then creating the curriculum and instruction around those needs. I mean, and that's really true for anything that when you're dealing with kids, including parenting, for example, that a solid relationship with that child will do wonders for the education of that child.
And, of course, that is exactly what we want here for North Carolina school kids. Terry Stoops is the Director of Education Studies, the Vice President for Research at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program. I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.